Well, I think we've had an excellent discussion thus far on some of the bigger policy issues, and I think the perspective from the industry was fascinating because I know that that is puzzling still to a lot of us. And so I thank both those panelists. What you're going to hear now is from people who really the people who have to apply for and use these NSP funds. So we're going to have a conversation about how this really works on the ground and how what you heard earlier today affects their success and perhaps what we might be able to do differently. We're going to open with Karen Leon-Denis, who's going to talk about the system-wide NSP survey study. We're then going to hear from Terry Gillen, the City of Philadelphia, and then Andrew French, who's at the other end of Pennsylvania in Fayette County. They're going to talk about their experiences implementing NSP. And then Amanda Roberts from Enterprise Community Partners is going to discuss some broader neighborhood stabilization policy issues. And we've all agreed among ourselves that what we've heard thus far is pretty consistent with much of what we were going to say, which tells me we're on to something. But we also want to allow plenty of time for your questions, your comments, your observations, and your ideas. So I want to start with Karen.
Good afternoon. As Ruth had said, I'm from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta, but today I'm wearing a slightly different hat in that I am representing a Federal Reserve System study that was conducted and is still in process of kind of the analysis phase that started in 2009. And several of my colleagues from around the system, as well as Enterprise Community Partners, who was also working with us on this study, are in the room today. So the collective knowledge of the folks here is pretty great, and I'm honored to be able to share some of the early results that we have. But what I wanted to start and what I was asked to do was to answer the question of why did we tackle this project and what did we hope to learn from it. And when NSP1 was first announced, there was a lot of desire to gather information and understand local implementation, planning, and implementation efforts. And so we asked around and we looked at other partners that we had had in the past to see, was anybody able to take on this study now? Is this something that the Federal Reserve System could help with? And what we found is that the resources were just not widely available from a lot of different common organizations that do this kind of research to jump in and take a look at this. And the Federal Reserve System, with 12 banks throughout the country and with community development expertise in all of those banks, was able to leverage the relationships that we already have with communities that we work with on a regular basis to kind of jump in and try to get a better understanding of what was going on with NSP1. And in part, we found this really important because we recognize that with such a serious housing issue facing these communities, and with so many communities had never tackled anything of this scale before, that the community development professionals in these different localities, this was going to be a new task with a very short timeline. And so there was something unique about it. But in addition to that, we recognize that even though NSP1 had an 18-month window for obligating the funds, neighborhood stabilization was going to continue for a long time. And so the lessons that we could learn and share with others through doing this kind of study were going to be valuable for the years to come. And so even though NSP1 is coming to a close very shortly, NSP2 is on its way, NSP3, and expectations that communities are going to be involved in these efforts for quite some time. So what we did, beginning in the fall of 2009, we started interviewing and surveying NSP administrators throughout the country. We talked to a total of 93 NSP programs in 26 different states. And we recognized that it wasn't a random sample that we had selected, but we did select a very diverse sample, both large and small communities, some of which you're going to hear from today, to understand better what was happening in the different markets. And what I'm going to do today, actually, is share with you some of the very kind of high-level preliminary findings that we had heard and that are actually very consistent with what we've heard from the other panelists in sessions earlier today. So I'll go very quickly through it, and I will also refer you to, in the black folders that everyone has, there is a brief write-up of these preliminary findings, The full study will be available in the next several months and will include not only kind of some basic quantitative analysis, but as well as sort of the qualitative information that we gather through the interviews, which provide us with a much better context for what's happening. So the first set of findings I'm going to talk about is kind of setting the stage for NSP, or what was the stage that was set already for many of the NSP grantees. And the first thing is that we heard repeatedly that subprime lending was really the driver of foreclosure problems in these communities, with some exceptions. And so with Florida, California, Nevada, and Arizona, we heard that it was a steep price decline that was really driving their foreclosure problem. What we also saw, though, is that when you look at NSP funding compared to what these communities had typically received in community development block grant funding, as well as home funding, this was four or more times the amount of dollars that they typically received. And the question that's raised by that is, with communities that have historically received community development dollars, they're able to develop the resources, the infrastructure, the partnerships, and the capacity to deal with these issues. In communities that didn't have that ability to do that on the front end, the 18-month window could be a particular challenge for them. The other thing that we asked the grantees that we had spoke with about is, what kinds of activities did they have experience in that were NSP-related type activities before they received their NSP funding? And across the board, we heard overwhelmingly that homeowner assistance and financing mechanisms, as well as acquisition and rehab, were the more common experience, sets of experience that the community developers came into the program with, but that things like only 19% of those that we had surveyed actually had previous experience with land banking, for example, which I think we're going to hear a little bit more about later. We also asked questions about preparing for NSP, and we asked questions about targeting. And we heard a lot about targeting in our previous panel. And one of the things that the respondents told us in surveys and interviews is that about 70% of the respondents said that they really targeted the neighborhoods with the most dire conditions, the places that had the highest foreclosure rates. And so one of the things that we'll be looking at going forward is, how does that play out in terms of the ability to actually obligate funds in a timely manner when you're dealing with those kinds of communities, as opposed to looking at maybe tipping point communities or other types of communities. The other things that we had really looked at was that, how did they deal with the capacity issue, recognizing again that many of these communities may not have had the capacity to deal with these issues, and so where did they look for new partnerships and nonprofit organizations? 84% of our respondents said that that's who they turned to build that local capacity to deal with these issues. That was not the only group. They also hired new staff. They subcontracted with for-profit entities and other options. But nonprofits were largely the go-to partners to deal with NSP. I want to move on quickly just to structuring NSP programs. And what we learned in that is that acquisition and rehab is the dominant activity, and that's no surprise. Acquiring properties was largely what NSP was structured was somewhat intended for, and so many of the grantees were doing just that. And then the other thing that we noted is that the grantees in many cases were undertaking activities which they did not have previous experience in, and that's just raises the question of, with such a tight time frame, developing that capacity and that knowledge and expertise and partnerships to learn new programs, to develop new processes. It's something, once again, that we heard in our previous panel. It took a better part of the 18 months to get all of the parts of this mechanism kind of moving forward. And so I think that we hear that also from the grantees as well. The last thing I'd like to do is just refer you to an article that is in the compendium that you received today. Harriet Neuberger, who is the lead on this NSP study from the Philadelphia Fed, and sitting over there, has an article that really looks at the acquisition and rehab component of NSP. And so it's part of this larger study, and I think that's a good place to see some of the preliminary findings.
It's a reality, Terry. I'm Terry Gillen, and I'm just going to describe briefly how the program works in Philadelphia and some of the lessons learned and maybe policy implications of what we've been doing in Philly. We are doing acquisition and rehab, I would say the one main characteristic of our program, though, is that it's really a developer-based model. It's a model under which the developers really end up taking the responsibility for doing the acquisition, the rehab, and they take the market risk because they don't get paid, frankly, until they sell the property to a buyer. The somewhat good news about Philly is that we didn't have as bad a foreclosure problem as many other cities. We do, however, have a significant long-term vacancy problem, and we have a high poverty program. So we were a little bit not sure how it would work, but we felt the market was strong enough in enough of the city that we would be able to sell these properties, and that's turning out to be the case. But it's a developer-based model, and we went that route for a couple reasons. We felt like the developers really had the market knowledge. We also, because there was such a short time frame, we didn't have the time to really do as much of the planning. I mean, we did do targeting, and we targeted our high foreclosure neighborhoods, but we really felt that the developers were really the people that were even more knowledgeable about the market. It's sort of an opportunity driven model. And right now we have 48 qualified developers participating in the program. I would say maybe a third of them are really not very active. The most interestingly, one of the findings for us has been the most active and successful developers overwhelmingly have been the for-profit ones and not the not-for-profit ones. And I don't know if that says something about the not-for-profit community in Philadelphia or what, but that's sort of an interesting finding for us, is we're finding that the nonprofit developers simply can't move fast enough and can't turn the houses around, frankly, quickly enough. So that's been interesting for us. I'll make a couple of other points. I'll give you a couple of facts about the Philadelphia program. We've committed about $24 million in state and HUD money to the program. We are fully obligated as of about a couple of weeks ago. We've expended about 40%. We're going to end up doing, under NSP1, about 90 houses. Row houses are the basic, housing stock in Philadelphia. But we'll do about 85 units of multifamily housing as well. Average purchase price of our houses is about $65,000, and the average subsidies running also about $65,000. And the subsidy ended up being much, much larger than we had anticipated when we started the program, partly because we just found that the houses needed more work. Lots of times they've been sitting out there longer than we would have liked, and so they needed more work, and partly it was just sort of all the requirements, between the lead paint and the new systems. And so we ended up doing fewer houses than we thought we would when we started the program because the subsidy ended up having to be larger. I'll make a couple quick other points that it's in terms of sort of policy issues. One of the things that's good for us about NSP in Philly is that it has forced us to do a little bit of strategic thinking and a little bit of planning. And we've been doing a lot of our work in not necessarily the worst off neighborhoods of Philadelphia. Those neighborhoods actually had gotten the lion's share of funding under the previous city administration. And our funding's been going to the next tier up. So it's sort of interesting because it has changed some of the neighborhoods that we're working with in Philadelphia. I think one of the good things about our program is that we really did hit the ground running. The first person I hired was a laid-off banker because I said, I don't know anything about banking. So then I hired the rest of my staff, and I should give a shout-out to Dana Hanshin and Palin Chin, who are here, and back at the office is John Carpenter, because they're the people that really, really do this program. And in response to Harriet's paper, I'll just make 2 points. One is on the environmental review. We were in some ways fortunate because our Office of Housing already had a relationship with the planning department, so that we could turn around environmental reviews in about 4 or 5 days, because they've got somebody that they actually have at the planning commission who is paid for partially out of CDBG money. So that's the way we were able to sort of turn around environmental reviews. But Harriet flagged that as a problem for a lot of cities. So if you're having that problem, you might want to think about that. We don't do the actual acquisition. The Redevelopment Authority, which is my agency, is a very burden. It's burdened with lots of regulatory restrictions, not the least of which is that every acquisition and disposition has to be approved by City Council. So our staff, yeah, welcome to Philadelphia. So our staff figured out a way that we could finance the acquisition and the loan to the developer, but we actually don't take title in Philadelphia, which is sort of interesting. I have 2 minutes left. I'll give a shout-out to the trust, because we were part of the First Look program, and we did find that before the First Look system was in place, it was really a nightmare for us. And after it was in place, then we really started cranking through, and we've probably looked at 900 to 1,000 properties as part of that process. So we were delighted when Secretary Donovan announced that that was going public. And I think that's it. I think those are my main points.
Okay. My name is Andrew French. I'm the executive director of the Redevelopment Authority in Fayette County, Pennsylvania. Obviously, many of you might not know about Fayette County, Pennsylvania. It's not Cleveland and it's not Philadelphia, but it's somewhere in between. So I'll just give you a little bit of background, and I just have a few slides here. We are located in southwestern PA. We're about an hour south of Pittsburgh. We're a pretty rural county. We've got about 150,000 residents that live there. Pennsylvania is somewhat unique, like in other parts of the country, in that our government systems are pretty fragmented. So I have one county, and I service the whole county, but there's 42 municipalities in the county that we actually work with. So it's about 800 square miles in size. So it ranges from kind of a suburban type of feel in certain locations to a more rural feel and a more mountainous feel. I know every time I come to some of these conferences, we always talk about blight and we talk about foreclosures. And I'll just put a plug in. Fayette County does have some very wonderful assets. We hope that you all would come and visit Fayette County. It's home to the five-star resort Nemacolin Woodlands. It's also home to some of the best whitewater rafting on the East Coast, Ohio Pile State Park, that plays host to about 1.5 million people a year. To enjoy the park and the great outdoors. So, and we have two Frank Lloyd Wright houses, Falling Water and Kentuck Knob. I'll just give a quick background to a premise too. Now I'll talk about some of the negative stuff. We kind of were on the forefront in Fayette County regarding the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. I actively participate with our National Association of Housing and Redevelopment Officials, or NARO, serving on a committee, and so I really kind of followed the evolution of the Neighborhood Stabilization Program from its infancy all the way through its passage. We were actively participating with the state as well in terms of how they were establishing their policy. In Pennsylvania, they received about $60 million in NSP funding that they subsequently awarded out to 33 different grantees, so we were one of those 33 grantees. We received $1.8 million in NSP funding, and a couple weeks ago, the state actually came back to us and awarded us another $600,000 in NSP funding because we were doing such a good job at obligating. Last month's report, actually, with our NSP and then reusing the program income, we were actually about 120% obligation rate because we've been using the program income that we generated. Fayette County, as I mentioned, is rural, but it's also a little bit depressed. It's got some drastic challenges. We're actually third in the state in terms of subprime mortgage rates at 38%. There are some census tracts within the city of Uniontown, which is the seat of Fayette County, where the subprime mortgage rate was actually 60 to 80%. We were able to find out that about a third of those at the time we made our NSP application were actually in some rate. They weren't current. They were actually in some rate of foreclosure. We also have, since we're an older community, we've got a lot of vacant properties. About 10.5% of our housing stock is actually vacant, and over 50% of that number has been vacant for over 2 years, for two years or more. I know earlier we heard some folks mention about Boomsburg, and I like that phrase. Our boom was actually probably about 100 years ago. our bust probably took place starting in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. And then we sort of somewhat stabilized in that we're still depressed, but we really, again, didn't see that huge peak like so many places in Pennsylvania and in rural areas. We really didn't see, you know, the drastic increase in home prices or the drastic increase in construction. So we're, you know, we're depressed, but we're at least realistic about it. We know that we can admit that we're depressed, I guess, and we're not fooling anybody. Just quickly, I'll you know, throw out some of the highlights. And again, remember, we're a smaller area, so I can't compete again with Philadelphia and Cleveland, but that we've heard about. We did a multi-pronged approach like so many communities. The first approach that we did was some new construction. We actually, pre-NSP, had identified some properties that had blighted structures on them. We used some other funding, whether it was through CDBG or through our Affordable Housing Trust Fund, to actually purchase those properties, deal with the blight. So we had those properties already acquired and assembled. We worked with a local nonprofit group, and in many of these, we worked with them. They're a certified housing development organization, or CHOTO. And it helped us tremendously because I think we as a redevelopment authority, while we do directly implement a lot of programs, what we do serve as best is probably as the banker. As you know, we kind of make sure that everybody complies with all the rules and regulations, but then we kind of like to hand off the funding to the nonprofit to actually do some of the single-family housing work. And so we were actually able to construct five properties. I'll mention, too, we targeted our NSP money to three specific communities, Masontown and then the two cities of Connellsville and Uniontown within the county. And we did that for a number of reasons. You know, we had the mapping. We knew where the foreclosures were at. We also knew where these tipping point neighborhoods were at. So we knew where the worst of the worst were, and we knew where the ones that we could make an impact by doing, you know, a handful of houses. So again, we were able to construct five properties. We have six properties currently under construction using a combination of the NSP program income and the additional NSP funds that we're getting. The average NSP investment is $139,000 per house, and the average appraised value is $150,000 per house. We did acquisition and rehab. Again, this kind of shows the tipping point neighborhoods that I refer to. This particular house, and I think, I don't know if that lights up, but it's the aerial view. It's actually the large structure that's in the center of this block. This block was relatively stable. It's, you know, primarily home ownership, but this property had been in foreclosure for an extended amount of time, and so that's why we targeted that particular property. And we did that with all of our acquisitions and rehabilitations. We've done, as that slide indicates, eight properties through that, with the average rehab cost of being $58,500, and the total total NSP investment about $96,500 per house. We've also done some demolition and blight abatement. So we've completed 23 properties. We have another that are 15 properties are pending. And that's my last slide, just to kind of send home the fact about blight abatement, because, as I said, we're an older community, in a rural community, but that's probably the number one challenge that we face as you travel throughout Fayette County. You go through a lot of smaller, different communities that have been blighted for decades, and definitely in need of additional resources, consistent, substantial resources to address that blight. That picture actually is of a little borough called Brownsville Borough, All of the properties, when you see that panned out view, all of those properties but one is vacant. As you can see, the shows one of the exterior of the buildings, beautiful architecture, but if you take a look at the inside, not so much.
Well, one of the privileges of being the last person on the last panel of the day is that I've heard everybody who's come before me, and my assignment for today was to kind of give some federal policy lessons on NSP. But as we went through the day, I noted that a lot of people had federal policy lessons on NSP, many of which overlapped with the ones I had prepared, which is fine. That means I can breeze through this and we can get to Q&A. But I also think that that really drives home the fact that NSP has been a uniquely policy-centric program. And I mean that at the federal level. I mean that at the local and the state level, and that everybody who is engaged with NSP in any way, shape, or form is thinking about the policy implications, is thinking about how we need to tweak policy here or there to try and get this to work better, whether it's actually to get NSP, the program, to work better, or it's to get our end results and to stabilize our neighborhoods and to have that work better. So one of the lessons that I've had going through this whole policy, again, DC, federal-centric NSP world, is that though it hasn't been easy, it's been a lot easier because we have worked together. I sit in a public policy office in Washington, D.C., but I talk almost daily with people on the ground who are running the NSP program, or certainly at least the other people on my team at Enterprise. And, you know, everybody is in communication, and everybody is thinking and working together and figuring out how we can do this, partially because it was hard. It just took a while to figure out what was in the notice, and partially because it's necessary. And, we have the task force, the National Foreclosure Prevention and Neighborhood Stabilization Task Force, that I think has been very important in this space. And it's got about 250 members. Many of you in this room may be members. And we meet regularly once a month. We talk about these issues, and we advocate for these issues. And whether it's a task force per se, or many of the people who are involved in this, I think one of the real successes of NSP is that we've had a lot of receptiveness from Congress and HUD. And I look around the room, and I know some of you in this room are from Congress or HUD, and I think a great big thank you. Despite the fact I may continue to call you with more asks, the truth is that, you know, we've gotten a couple major technical fixes through Congress. We have gotten a lot of corrections to come out of HUD, whether it was just new definitions or bridge notices or policy guidances or those sorts of things, that this really has been a collaborative process with people willing to work with us on all fronts to make this happen. And then, of course, the other group, and that was the panel before us, that's been instrumental in working with us to try and make this happen, is those in the private sector and banks and servicers and the industry, as we've developed the systems to have this program work. So with that was, again, I think one of the most important things that we have developed here are the relationships and the systems. And again, I don't want to talk too much about this because you already heard this point. But whether it's what's happened in the major financial institutions to help make this program work, whether it's the data systems you heard about in the morning, we really have kind of developed whole new lexicons, whole new relationships. You know, it's sort of a joke that you come to these sorts of convenings, and it's a little bit like old home week. Oh, I saw you at the last Living Cities thing, or I saw you at, the last time the Fed did this. But I think it's true that this has been wonderful in the sense that there has been a lot of continuing collaboration to make this move forward. But having said that, I think some of the problems with NSP were that it was certainly a product of its time. And by that I mean when it was created in mid-2008. That may not seem like so long ago in calendar years, but in terms of foreclosure crisis, it certainly was. We've already talked about how one of, I think, NSP's major failings was that it was created in a time when there was mortgage credit. And we assumed that there would be demand out there. We assumed that if we give localities money, they buy up houses, they make them pretty, somebody will buy them. There will be a market for that. And we all know that that's not always the case, certainly not in every market, that whether it's through mortgage tightening or just depressed markets as a whole, we're not necessarily seeing the demand. And NSP localities are suffering under the weight of the now very beautifully rehabbed homes that they own and cannot sell. So one thing I know that Rob Grossinger mentioned just a little bit ago that we've been talking about is maybe we need to create some, whether it's federally backed or state backed mortgages, mortgage incentives, mortgage programs that are targeted to these NSP neighborhoods. We've put $7 billion, or will have put $7 billion of federal funding into these census tracts. You can pull up on a website. You know exactly where they are. Maybe we need to start putting some mortgage credit into those neighborhoods. Attach it to counseling, put, you know, income certifications, perhaps total purchase price limits, all of those sorts of things. But ensure that we do have a market. We do have credit mortgages for those who are willing to buy those properties. You know, another thing that NSP was a product of its time in is that it was created before the other slew of now familiar government acronyms, HAMP, HAFA, HARP, you know, the Emergency Mortgage Relief Program, all necessary, all important, but not always working in coordination with NSP. We just heard again about how servicers were told to institute foreclosure moratoriums. At the same time, you had NSP grantees out on the ground being told, go buy foreclosures. And at the time, before we had the new definitions, a foreclosure was a foreclosure, and you had no real wiggle room as to how you might be able to access a short sale or a deed in lieu property or something to that effect. So, you know, I think the last thing I'll throw out here, just because, again, a number of things I was going to say have already been said, but we can continue to talk, is that we've heard a lot about low-capacity NSP grantees. And, yes, they exist. But I think there's a couple things for federal policy going forward that we should consider. One, and we heard about this at the beginning from Karen, was that some of these were grantees who were accustomed to a tiny fraction of the federal community development and housing funding that they got from NSP. And they were given $18 million to spend in 18 months when they're accustomed to having $1 million. And they just didn't have the capacity. There was a huge need for capacity building. And though we've certainly seen a ramp up on technical assistance coming from HUD formally, or maybe even through, you know, intermediaries like ourselves or NeighborWorks or LISC, it's also been the case that it takes time. It takes time to develop this, to develop the whole new systems, to, you know, interpret the regs, learn a new language to talk with the banks or the trust or what have you. And the other thing just with all of that, I see I'm getting the 1 minute, is that, again, we had talked about the Bloombergs, that these were also literally geographically new areas that didn't have a community development structure, and that we do need to think about that going forward as to how we can help these localities build that capacity before we burden them with this large sum of money and a short time limit. So thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up to all of you now. Surely you have questions, comments, or your own experiences with NSP that I think would be of interest and that perhaps this panel can respond to.
I've been a little surprised today that there hasn't been much discussion, and maybe this is the right panel, about the sort of Faustian deal that we've had to have for the last 12 months or so, where it was very important to obligate the dollars in order to prove that the NSP program would work, while at the same time the push to obligate dollars really has resulted in a fairly low level of leverage of those dollars. And it was music to my ears to hear the servicers pleading for more leverage with the program. But what I'd like to hear thoughts on from this panel is, do we really believe that HUD will hear that message, can in this political environment listen to that message, and really make a change in encouraging the leveraging of NSP dollars to have more impact?
And could we also have your name and organization, please?
Yes, Mary Tingerthal from the Housing Partnership Network.
Thank you. Who wants to start?
I'll mention maybe we haven't done the level of leveraging that we would have liked to see, but I know in Fayette County we have leveraged. So whether that was using our local, Affordable Housing Trust Fund to purchase the properties, using CDBG funds to demolish the properties, many of the properties, both in the new construction as well as in the acquisition and rehab, obviously we're selling those properties. So we're going out and actually getting private financing, either through a traditional lender or through USDA as an insured lender. And so typically, you know, we're seeing 60 to 80% of those funds coming back to us in the form of program income, which then we're reinvesting.
And Mary, I'm sure you know this already, but I think in some respects it's going to get worse before it gets better. Those of you who are involved in NSP 2 know that the statute says you have to expend, not obligate, expend 50% of your funds in 2 years and 100% in 3 years. And that's turning into a bit of a nightmare situation because that includes program income. And there's some really perverse incentives to just go get rid of this money as quickly as possible, even more so than NSP 1. Having said that, NSP 3 did strip the 18-month obligation period statutorily. There is no time period. We've heard from HUD they might implement some sort of time period. I think what isn't working in favor of all of us, though, is comments we've heard a lot today, which is that relationships and systems have been developed, and that as we go through this and we go into 2 and 3 and who knows where we'll stop, that there's just more communication between foundations who have money to leverage and banks that have money to leverage and, you know, intermediaries who are thinking more creatively, sorry, and those sorts of things.
Is there another question? Over here.
Hi, I'm Karen Griffin, and I'm from St. Ambrose Housing Aid Center in Baltimore, Maryland. And I missed my opportunity to actually address this question to Secretary Donovan, and that has to do with the NSP 2 consideration of nonprofit developers as consortium members and therefore not eligible for a development fee. And this, where not for-profit developers can make as much money in a development fee as they can, nonprofit developers who often depend on a capped 15% development fee cannot actually get that under NSP 2. And it is part of our economic model, which could have some impact on the fact that nonprofit developers have not been successful in Philadelphia. And I guess that's more a comment than a question, but I really needed to say it.
Well, I'll just clarify the one point that you made, which is I was only talking about NSP 1, and in Philadelphia, we give for-profit and nonprofit developers the same fee, and so that's not the reason nonprofit developers in Philly haven't been as successful. I don't know what the reason is, but that's not it. So,
what I would add from a policy perspective is that we're very aware of this and have been working on it and communicating with HUD on it, and trying to find ways to make this work, because you're absolutely right. We estimate about 100 nonprofit organizations around the country were blindsided by this. Either they didn't know or didn't guess, and there's some gray area as to what extent they should have known, but trying to find solutions to make this workable for the developers, who you're absolutely right. I mean, you have to pay your salaries, you have to pay for the lights, and HUD and their regulations, and that it's based off of CDBG, and that we have, you know, thousands and thousands of pages of regulation that we need to work through, and how we can, you know, at the end of the day, make NSP2 work. Because I've certainly heard, you know, that there's nonprofits around the country who are saying, I'm not doing this. I'm backing out. That's it. And, you know, if we can't make this happen because of one regulatory hurdle, then we need to have some real serious conversations.
Over here.
Hello? Yeah. I'm Jim Vitarello. I'm with GAO. I'm a housing specialist there. And I was wondering, I don't know the NSP rules that much, but I was wondering, can you use NSP funds to provide soft seconds to homeowners and to, affordable housing rental developers? And if so, have you tried using it to both increase the availability of conventional and maybe even FHA funding, and also, provide somewhat lower rates because you're providing lower loan-to-value ratios?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know. I mean, we have not done that. So.
Does anybody in the audience know the answer to that?
The answer is yes.
Yes.
The answer is yes.
The answer is
yes.
But no, we haven't.
We have not. Yeah, I mean, our arts, I mean, in essence, I think our, because after we actually either construct the home or rehab it, you know, we're actually providing some additional financing incentive when we sell it to the first-time home buyer or to the home buyer. So it actually turns into a portion of it. We'll use up to maybe 20% that'll turn into a deferred loan for that homeowner, and then they'll have to finance 80% of it through a traditional lender. But it has. I don't think that we really saw that big of a difference in terms of the financing through some of the lenders that we work with. Primarily, all of the new construction we go through USDA. The acquisition rehabilitation, we've gone through some local lenders, and they've been willing to participate. But it's definitely made our funding go a lot further.
Right.
One of the things I'll also add to that is that in talking with several grantees, that on the front end, when they were coming up with their NSP plans and brought in the typical, who would be providing the typical mortgages to buyers down the road, when they had those people at the table early on and crafted an NSP plan, a program that actually kind of matched what the lenders were going to be able to support, they seem to be having more success. Now, I'll say, and I'll add to that, that as conditions have changed, it still seems like credit is tightening more. And so even in those places where they did have those early conversations, they're now still running into hurdles of getting that type of financing going forward. But they had some real initial success because they had the conversations early on.
With Montgomery County, Maryland. It was mentioned earlier the issue about program income. How much thought is being given to changing the rules on program income? Because it really does stifle the creativity that we're looking for in terms of leveraging. We, to avoid giving money back, have decided to use all of ours for rental housing so that our housing authority can house their 3- and 4-bedroom families. But I think if we had the opportunity to use that program income in a revolving way over time, we would have done it in a different manner.
I guess I would just note that you're talking about NSP1. Yeah, so there are some differences between NSP1 and NSP2, and that's what we were alluding to earlier in terms of NSP2 has to be expended. As a whole, and maybe people who know this better than I do in the audience can correct, but it's my understanding that you can continue to use program income, that you have to obligate. That's what everybody's talking about, their 18-month obligation. That's a one-time thing. But your program income can continue to be rolled over. Well, no, I believe that's been stripped.
There's a question over on this side of the room.
I'm George Rothman with MANA here in Washington, D.C. We're a nonprofit housing developer, builder, and have our own mortgage company. And I'd like to thank is it Amanda who mentioned the issue of demand? Because unless there's sufficient demand, the program won't be ultimately successful, and that isn't discussed much. But with one suggestion you made regarding a mortgage product, it does exist. And it can be just a regular FHA loan that has greater leverage, that has a very low down payment requirement. That's what we think will work. And also, to get rid of it, or certainly reduce the severity of the resale restrictions, because that turns off good quality buyers. Thank you.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that. We are having problems getting mortgage financing. In part because of the affordability requirements. We have a lot of banks that are sort of still trying to deal with that. So that is a problem.
Andrew, what do you see in the way of demand?
Well, and again, to qualify, we're dealing, in our case, with a small number of houses. So it's only, you know, 8 homes that we've acquired and rehabbed and, you know, another dozen that we'll actually construct. So I don't know that we've really been impacted by not seeing, you know, by seeing a huge drop in demand. I think that the amount of units that we produce on an annual basis through this program really meets the need. And again, with the other bonus, I guess, with the NSP requirements is if you don't mix it with CDBG funds, you can go up to that higher income level as well. And so I think we found that beneficial to us to be able to attract. So even though we did have, you know, a drop off in some of the private construction folks that were building units maybe between 150 to 250,000, you know, I think we've been able to actually, you know, show them a product that you know, when we're done appraises for 150,000 and attract those higher income families.
Carolina Reed with the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And I think this is probably mostly to maybe Karen and Terry, if you have experience in your markets. But one of the things we're finding is that after the nonprofit purchases and rehabs the home is well above the sort of market value for the neighborhood. And even though the home is much higher quality, buyers are choosing to buy the unrehabbed homes for less money and then live in that sort of cheaper house for the buyers that do actually have money. And I'm wondering, do you have the same thing, or are you really able, even after rehab, to offer an affordable home?
We're not. I think one of the things that we do at the outset when we talk to the developers is we have a lot of dialogue with them about whether the house can be rehabbed and then sold for what is a reasonable price in that market. So we actually were having sort of a similar conversation yesterday because we were talking about how our houses are often the nicest house on the block. You know, are we over improving it in the sense that we could get more houses done if we didn't do so much, but we don't think we are, but it just means that we're subsidizing it, you know, with a bigger number than we'd like. But in fact, our houses are often, you know, they haven't been sitting that long. I mean, people are buying them. I mean, we're running into this mortgage problem that we hadn't anticipated, but people are buying them. So we think we're pricing them right. I mean, we reject a lot of houses. I mean, we would probably reject 4 out of every 5 houses that we look at because we, you know, one of the reasons is we really try to make sure we hit the market properly.
I think, you know, in most of the more in-depth study that I've done has been focused more on Georgia and Florida, even though the earlier results I was reporting were national in scope. And it's a very mixed story in terms of the price of those properties going forward and their ability to sell those properties. There are definitely communities in Florida that have because of the way they've targeted their investments and where they're doing their work, and I would say that this tends to be more not inner city types of investments, that they have not run into that problem as much. And I'm kind of talking kind of generically about this. In some of the grantees that have target areas in inner city areas, frankly, they're kind of just getting off the ground now with sales, and we're just starting to see. Just recently, I attended one of City of Atlanta's first NSP homes sold. And so we're just now starting to see what that market's really going to look like. They're already running into some challenges in terms of the financing side. But what, you know, I'm hearing repeatedly, we've heard it on this panel, is that they're sinking in more subsidies to some of the homes than they had anticipated.
In your district? Because that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a lot of green rehab and sort of the popularity of green, and the homes just aren't selling. I mean, we have six beautiful properties in Oakland that can't find any buyer whatsoever.
So early on, we took a look at what NSP grantees were really focusing on green development, and the numbers were surprisingly low. I think it was what I'm learning now as the program has gone forward is that it was just underreported at the time. That because I think there's a lot of nonprofits who have already kind of advanced towards some of the green building strategies that's in place. City of Atlanta, for example, has worked with South-Faced and Earthcraft communities to really develop sort of standards of green for their rehabs. But frankly, when you look at the marketing for these properties, there's not a lot of talk of the green features of them. And so I don't see, at least in some cases, I don't see that as a marketing strategy for the properties.
My name is George McCarthy, a.k.a. Mac, from the Ford Foundation. And this is specifically for Karen, and maybe Amanda can comment on it too. We spent a lot of time today talking about trying to facilitate the conveyance of properties from whomever is holding them now to the NSP grantees. And I'm wondering, to what extent have you seen that that is actually the problem for NSP grantees to be able to actually allocate their money? Is it their inability to transact on properties, or is it something else? Because it seems to me that every time we think we know what the problem is, we're usually wrong. And I'm not saying that, of course, the infinite wisdom of the National Community Stabilization Trust is profound, but is it really the problem that people have confronted in NSP 1?
I think the one thing I would say to that is that I don't know that any of our assessments of the problems have been wrong. It's just that the problems keep changing on us. And so when we were out surveying communities and interviewing communities at the end of 2009, we heard repeatedly the difficulty that the grantees were having in identifying properties, identifying servicers, actually making a connection, negotiating the discount, that all of these were really serious issues and obstacles, and that they were losing out to investors who could quickly make those transactions. That problem, when you talk to grantees as they've progressed with their that problem seems to be diminishing, that they're figuring out that process. And that, you know, that's not the main problem. And for many, but not all, communities, the problem is now the financing and the demand issues. And the truth, though, is, and I think Amanda and I had this conversation several months ago, is that because the issues of foreclosure are so diverse and the community capacity and resources are so diverse that there's almost an impossible to have a one-size-fits-all kind of categorization of the problem or the solution, because I've seen communities who have overcome all of these problems in different ways, and it's because they just have this unique set of assets that they can draw on to make that work, whereas other communities never can pull together that unique set of assets and need the technical assistance and the mentoring and partnerships with, you know, the successful communities to overcome the ever-evolving set of problems that are going to happen as we try to stabilize the communities.
And I guess the only thing I would add to that is, you know, initially it was just figuring out who you call at whatever bank or servicer. And as Karen had mentioned, they got over that hurdles, but some of them remain, and some of them are just the nature of federal funding. You know, I have to do an environmental review, so I have to put a contingency in. Obviously, we've heard a lot about investors. You know, we've the tenant protection form that everybody has to get signed that says that they, you know, that there wasn't a tenant there or that they complied with the law. I think those are the types of things that are continuing to trip people up. Are they stopping NSP around the country? No. But I think, but we still continue to hear about that is when it comes to your acquisition problems, even once you're doing first look with the trust, there's still those sorts of things that can get in your way.
I'll just mention, too, from our perspective, again, from a smaller community that dealt with it, early on, we actually did a tremendous amount of research to try to track where all these foreclosed properties were at. That involved sending a staff member over to physically sit down with the prothonotary and the recorder of deeds and hold the hand of the sheriff's department and kind of look at what the information that they had. And we actually looked at it over a period of, I think it was like 2 years prior to the date that we submitted the application. And what we found is, you know, out of 300 properties that went through foreclosure, we had about 125 that were still owned by financial institutions. And when I looked at the list, there were about 75 different entities that own those 125 properties. Our experience, again, just talking to some of the colleagues, and maybe it wasn't correct, but it worked for us, was you know, we weren't going to bother with the banks because we knew that everybody else was having headaches at that time. Again, we're in a smaller community, so there's only a handful of realtors that deal with foreclosed properties, and by golly, I knew who those realtors were because I'd go to luncheons with them and Rotary Club with them, and so you knew them personally. And so we were actually able to form those relationships with the local realtors, and it seemed to work out best for us to be able to acquire, you know, again, the limited amount of properties that we needed to acquire.
Any final questions? Here you go.
Hi. Ira Goldstein, Reinvestment Fund. One quick question. With all the collective experience up there, if you think about it, NSP 1 and 2 were supposed to be they were parts of a stimulus bill. The money was supposed to hit fast, and it was supposed to do something very quickly and stimulate the economy and create jobs and fix markets and do all those other things. Was it wrongly placed in that bill? Should it not be? In other words, clearly it's not something that could have done something in 3 months or 6 months or 9 months, like, you know, putting a road in or doing something like that. Was it placed wrongly in the bill, or could you think of ways that it could have been written differently by Congress and interpreted by HUD so that it could truly have been stimulus? In other words, get that $6 billion out and do it quickly and have that stimulative effect.
Interesting question.
Yeah. I guess I'll take a stab at that differently. So first of all, I think NSP was very narrow. There are five eligible uses, and in many respects, that created national tunnel vision, and everybody tried to figure out how I can do my five eligible uses without thinking about all of the other comprehensive aspects of neighborhood stabilization. So, you know, code reform and, you know, mortgages and those sorts of things. But that's sort of counter-stimulative because I'm telling you to give me more time. So I think, you know, maybe some of the ways that we could have done this, and we got there eventually in April 2010, was around just the definitions of abandoned and foreclosed. A lot of people got tripped up by the fact, we talked about this already, you had to have a legitimately foreclosed property where, you know, the foreclosure proceedings had finished and the note had already transferred. But meanwhile, there weren't enough foreclosures on the market, or certainly not in your target neighborhood, or certainly not in your price range, and all of those sorts of things. If we had started back then in 2008, where we are now with the new definitions, where you just have to be delinquent, short sales are possible, you can have abandoned properties, you can have vacant properties, that, you know, it's just a wider universe of properties, I think that would have been a huge start right there. I, in my perfect world, would have seen a couple more waiver authorities used when it came to some things like environmental reviews and, you know, those sorts of things. You know, people from HUD or Congress in the room can probably chastise me and say that some of that's written in stone and can never, ever be changed. But I think it, you know, it really did trip people up a lot. Okay. I also would have probably used a little bit more of an intermediary approach. You know, I think we've heard a lot of praises of the trust, and one of their biggest successes is that they were an intermediary that had a national perspective, national relationships, and national scale. And it took the trust a while to reach that point, I know. But I think that, again, we've heard about these sort of low-capacity grantees that got 20 times their annual CDBG dumped in their lap and didn't necessarily have the systems or the know-how to deal with that. I think that if we had been ready with some TA and capacity building and intermediary support nationwide to begin with, that probably would have helped significantly as well.
Anybody else?
I'll just say, I guess the regulations, I always look at them as they are. They are what they are. As somebody who, you know, started their career when the Home Investment Partnership Program started, and seeing all the workings that that took to implement, I basically, you know, take them what they are. We'll deal with them. We'll get the money out on a local basis. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not happy when they make all these little tweaks and they make the changes. It makes our life much easier. As I kind of alluded to in my slides, you know, our problem is the lack of substantial, consistent resources to deal with some of the problems that at least we have again, in a more rural area that has a tremendous amount of blight that's existed for decades. So to the extent, and that goes back to the point of, you know, some of the low-capacity grantees. I don't think we're a low-capacity grantee. I think we're a pretty high performer, but if there were more substantial, consistent resources available to deal with some of these issues, I think that you would see the capacity of the grantees obviously increase as well. And there is a huge demand. I keep asking when I attend all these meetings with state and federal officials just to write me a check for $250 million and I could take care of all the blight that exists in Fayette County, but nobody's written me a check yet. So. And the secretary's gone, so...
Yeah, the only thing I think I would add to that, and I think it follows up on what Andrew was just saying, is and something that Carolina was saying earlier, is that the way that we have communities have developed more recently have been these boomburgs that don't come with a set of infrastructure to support them. And yet what is happening with NSP in some regards is building at least some of the foundation for community development going forward. And some more expertise in some of these places that did get hard hit by foreclosures. And so, you know, I see that as kind of a positive. And the other thing I think I see is that just the whole industry communications, and I know Amanda's already said this, but this whole industry of development communicating with each other and starting to understand each other's limitations as well as abilities, I think has been growing over time, and that seems very positive.
That actually ties to the question that I intended to answer, which follows a little bit up on Ira's point. My name is Dan Kildee with the Center for Community Progress. I used to be a public official back in Flint, Michigan. Moved here. The question I have is whether or not some of the promise of NSP, and this particularly would relate to two, has been realized in terms of not leveraging capital, but leveraging system or regulatory changes or basically the production model that we have in communities. Has that changed at all in your place? And do you think, for those of you that work in lots of places, that there are some things that could still be done as we go through this process that would help make NSP, if there is only a 3 and not a 4, 5, and 6, have a longer life in terms of changing the way we conduct business, some of the system hurdles that perhaps we've been able to push through with this process, having a longer life to them? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I can give you a partial answer. I'd have to think about it, really. It certainly has changed a little bit of the way we've approached our community development implementation in Philadelphia, because, as I said, in the previous administration, they had really, for whatever reason, directed all of their, most of the community development money to the very poorest neighborhoods. And we used NSP partly because it's where the high foreclosure neighborhoods was not the poorest neighborhoods. They were sort of the next tier, obviously, where there was equity in houses and predatory lending. But partly because there was other language in the NSP regs and grants that sort of we used to say to some of our recalcitrant council members and other people, hey, we've got to do what we think makes sense, which is to hit these neighborhoods that really are on the verge of turning. And those are the neighborhoods that we think make the most sense and where we should be putting our money. And that's where we've targeted NSP 1 and NSP 2. So for us, we've been able to use it to really do some rethinking of previous strategy and to do some basic planning, which had not been done sufficiently in Philadelphia previously. I'd have to think about the systems thing. I don't know about that. So that's a good question. I'll think about it.
I think, again, I'm at the national level. Honestly, I think we probably won't be getting 4, 5, 6, 7, although maybe I should go look at Amanda Fisher over there. I think what we can really take from NSP from a national federal policy level is to think about how NSP has focused the conversation on neighborhoods. The fact that we saw the word land banking in a federal statute. Yes, thumbs up. The fact that we saw demolition as a legitimate neighborhood stabilization strategy in a federal statute. And though we are going to see NSP dry up, and you know what? I think we all want that too. We don't want NSP 25. We don't, we don't want to continue to have to use federal resources to stabilize our neighborhoods because, quite frankly, we want our neighborhoods to be stabilized. But I do think that we can take those lessons and that focus on neighborhood and put it into other programs. So, you know, an easy one might be CDBG. You know, we all need to be talking using the advanced data systems we may have developed or vacant property registrations to inform CDBG targeting decisions. We need to be using NSP and, thinking about land banking and demolition to inform, you know, other resources, whether, again, it's home or CDBG. I know I use that example. But just kind of continuing to think around this neighborhood focus and this, again, maybe whether it's tipping point, whether the neighborhood started tipping point, or whether we're just targeting our resources enough to make them tipping point.
Time for one last question. Clearly, there are a couple of themes that emerged from this panel, but also from the day. We heard again and again talk about how important it is to have effective partnerships, a shared vision and strategy. We've also know only too well the enormity and complexity of the problem. What we haven't talked much about, but I think is an undercurrent here, is in this current economic and political environment, this sort of need for a quick fix. And so I'd like to ask each of you perhaps to close with your summation of what's reasonable to expect from a program. And some of you have touched on this a little bit, but what's reasonable to expect from a program like NSP? What are going to be indicators of success? What measures are we going to use? And how's that going to support those longer-term neighborhood stabilization policies and infrastructures that are critical to what happened, to what we're talking about 5 or 10 years in this room, 5 or 10 years from now?
You know, one of the things very early on when we were talking about the Federal Reserve System study on NSP was asking the question about how were grantees going to evaluate their own success. And I think it started a real internal conversation about what does success really look like. We have not, looking through all of the data, we haven't really kind of jumped on that question yet. But because of the media attention, a lot of definition of success has been in obligating the funds right now. What I would say from the communities that I've seen kind of progress from the early stages of NSP until today is that the ones that appear to feel successful in their programs right now are the ones that are setting in motion something that's going to be a longer-term strategy for stabilization, and those that are recognizing that they need to put the systems in place, the partnerships, the working with code enforcement, the working with their schools, with law enforcement, with others, to go down the longer road of stabilization in neighborhoods. And so those that probably are seeing NSP as the catalyst for kind of an ongoing strategy seem to be the successful ones.
Yeah, and I would piggyback on that and say that's certainly the case in Philadelphia. Again, I think the extent to which NSP has, it's done two things. One, it's allowed us to go into neighborhoods that we hadn't gone into before that really needed some attention and some financing, and now we're in these neighborhoods building some capacity, I think that's going to be really important for the city. I mean, it's critical for the city's overall success that we focus on some of these neighborhoods, and also that we I think as Amanda suggested that we incorporate some of this into our CDBG planning and into our CDBG thinking. And we're starting to do that. I mean, NSP1, I think we were all racing against a clock and trying to, you know, just sort of get things, get the car, you know, get the ignition turned on and get the car running. But under NSP2, I mean, we're already being way more creative, way more collaborative. We're leveraging, we're bringing in lots of other resources. We've got other city agencies at the table in a way that we felt like we couldn't under NSP1. And if that becomes a basis for how we think about community development in Philadelphia, it'll be a huge success from that perspective.
Well, I guess that's one of the benefits I have of being like a local practitioner is that I get to see the success every day. So I get to see the immediate success that we've had in terms of, you know, the new houses that are constructed and the families that move in, the house that we rehab. And so we've basically, you know, stabilized, you know, that particular block. And so definitely see the immediate in the ideal cases. Obviously, we see the future and ongoing success of that investment by seeing other private investment taking place, you know, in those communities and on those blocks. You know, we're going to continue our process that we have. You know, we deal with the resources that are given to us. We try to advocate for more, but, you know, we deal with what we have. And if that means that, you know, we continue to have to go on a block-to-block basis and deal with, you know, the crisis that's at hand, you know, we'll do that. Again, you know, I think we have developed the mindset of the more strategic investment. I think NSP has reinforced that so that we're not just investing the money to invest the money. We are taking a look at the communities that we're investing in, and we're trying to have the biggest impact with the limited dollars that we have. You know, looking into the future, you know, hopefully, you know, the funding does continue, whether it's through NSP or through other sources. As I said, that's our expertise in terms of trying to match up, you know, the local initiatives and needs that we need with the state and federal dollars that are available out there. Ideally, you know, someday the communities are stabilized, but I have a feeling that that's a long ways off. I've got good job security in Fayette County, I know that.
So obviously one of the major themes we've been hearing all day today is that NSP is so closely tied to what else is happening in the market. So your question about what is it reasonable to expect from NSP, I think that we do need to be realistic with the fact that it will make a big difference in some neighborhoods. Some neighborhoods are able to tightly target and leverage and partner and all of those sorts of things. But until unemployment goes down, until, you know, we can stop foreclosures, whether it's through HAMP mods or just everything cycles through, you know, NSP is one small piece in a huge, huge problem. Having said that, it's an important piece. It's a $7 billion piece, and it's been critical. And just to echo what everybody's already said, and I think I've said three or four times already today, is that, you know, I do think that the legacy of NSP will be the systems that develop, the relationships that develop, and the strategic thinking that develops. And I would hope that that's, yes, it's strategic thinking as to how we spend CDBG going forward, but it's also, I mean, let's be big about this. We're going to think more about transit-oriented development and what happens with sprawl, because we've talked about the Bloombergs, and maybe that doesn't work because maybe you have to have a two-hour drive in traffic to get to work. You know, I mean, I think we're going to be thinking about green building and how this is an opportunity to touch millions, well, maybe not millions, hundreds of thousands of properties and to rehab them green because it's good for the environment and it's good for that home buyer who has lower utility bills and those sorts of things. So I would hope that there's a spillover effect there in some of our macro thinking as well.
Please, I'm sorry, did you have one last comment?
Private sector and public sector in that area, and now there are many, many, many properties that are abandoned, half built, wants to buy those properties. They're selling at $50,000, brand new homes, 3 bedrooms, 4 baths, whatever, super nice properties. And you can't give them away. So from that perspective, if you're studying policy and thinking about integrating systems, one of the key components is going to be the transportation systems and the planning for the future. Because I think that that is a contributing factor to this particular situation, at least in our community. And I think as a Sunbelt city, you know, we're probably endemic, an example of a national problem.
Well, thank you, and thank all of you for your comments and questions, and special thanks to the panel.
Okay, we're going to move right along. So as you can see from the agenda, the next thing is going to be day one closing remarks from President Charles Evans from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. As Governor Duke said at the very beginning, this event today is part of a larger effort across the Federal Reserve System. Actually, if you look at the very front of the publication, you'll see there's an article that Charlie Evans a statement that Charlie Evans made about that. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Alicia Williams from the Chicago Fed, and she's going to introduce Charlie Evans.
Okay, I guess we're down to the wire here. As Joseph mentioned, my name is Alicia Williams from Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, and it's my distinct pleasure to introduce our next speaker, which is Dr. Charles Evans. Charlie is the president and CEO of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. In this capacity, Charlie serves on the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the Federal Reserve System's monetary policy-making body. As the head of the Chicago Fed, Charlie oversees the work of approximately 1,400 employees in Chicago and Detroit who conduct economic research, supervise financial institutions, promote community development, and provide payment services to commercial banks and the U.S. government. Before becoming president in 2007, Charlie was the director of research and a senior vice president at the Chicago Fed. He oversaw the bank's research on monetary policy, banking and financial markets, and regional economic issues. His own personal research focused on measuring the effects of monetary policy on U.S. economic activity, inflation, and financial market prices. This work has been published in numerous top academic journals, such as the Journal of Political Economy, the American Economic Review, and the Journal of Monetary Economics. Charlie taught at the University of Chicago, the University of Michigan, and the University of South Carolina. He received his bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Virginia and a doctorate in the field from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. In many ways, his entire academic and Fed career have served as preparation for his current roles. We're very happy that he's here with us today, so please help me welcome President Charlie Evans.
Thanks very much, Alicia, and good afternoon. I'm pleased to be here today to share a few comments as we close out the first day of this excellent conference on REO and vacant property strategies for neighborhood stabilization. The previous panel, the last speaker mentioned that it's a privilege to be the last panelist to speak, so it's certainly a high honor to be the final speaker today. And as I listened to one of the earlier panels on fostering a healthy regional market, I noticed a parallel in many of the comments to a town hall that I had with our employees in Chicago just yesterday. I gave them an update on the economy, and I noticed a number of similar concepts being mentioned in terms, problems, challenges, difficulties. I started making a list of the types of words that were used, like the difficult words versus the happier words of that panel, and unfortunately the ratio was quite unfortunate with that. I'm not going to be able to improve upon that myself, but I will note that there's a lot of enthusiasm, obviously, in all of these programs, and everybody is searching for the most effective solutions, and so that's a good thing, and I'm not optimistic on that. Most of you already have some appreciation for the work that the Federal Reserve System has been doing to address financial and economic instability. What is less well known is that the Federal Reserve also has been working hard to respond to the foreclosure crisis on Main Street. We've leveraged our research, community affairs, and supervision and regulation functions to support innovative foreclosure prevention and neighborhood stabilization strategies at the local level. I'd like to talk about that important work, especially a Fed program called MORE. But before I do that, I'd like to discuss some of the larger issues that relate to home ownership and foreclosure mitigation. As a nation, we've come to value home ownership because of the many benefits it brings for both families and communities. Perhaps foremost is its potential for building household wealth. In addition, however, communities with high levels of home ownership tend to have greater involvement in school and civic organizations, higher graduation rates, lower housing turnover, and higher home values. Simply stated, homeowners tend to put down deeper roots, and that's a good thing for communities as well as families. Recognition of these benefits has made encouraging home ownership a national priority. Tax incentives, FHA mortgage insurance, and sponsorship of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac all contributed to a long rise in the U.S. home ownership rate from 45% in 1940 to a peak of 69% in 2004. Of course, home ownership is only good for families and communities if it can be sustained. Home purchases that are highly leveraged or unaffordable subject the borrower to too much risk. There's no guarantee, as we've learned recently, that house prices will rise. Moreover, even in a strong economy, unforeseen life events and risks in local real estate markets represent vulnerabilities for highly leveraged borrowers. Thus, it was very destructive when, in the early part of this decade, dubious underwriting practices and mortgage products inappropriate for mass consumption became more common. It is difficult to understand how loose underwriting, high degrees of leverage, and the broad marketing of exotic and often very high-cost mortgage products could promote sustainable home ownership. In fact, these practices took us in the other direction, and home ownership began to decline even while mortgage underwriting standards continued to loosen. Moreover, partly as a result of these practices, we've seen an unprecedented housing market collapse that contributed to a very deep recession marked by many lost jobs. And home ownership has now declined for six straight years. Although there are some signs of general economic recovery and some evidence of home price stabilization, we are certainly not out of the woods. Projections suggest foreclosed housing units in the U.S. could reach as high as 3 million in 2010. The public policy response to the housing market collapse has become increasingly aggressive as the severity and extent of the collapse have become clearer. One might expect lenders to modify mortgages, making them more affordable for borrowers, rather than accepting large losses on foreclosed properties. However, for various reasons, the number of modifications has been lower than we might have hoped. Thus, federal government efforts such as the Home Affordable Mortgage Program, or HAMP, continue to evolve, and the search for solutions goes on. The Federal Reserve has had a long-standing interest in these issues, but our work has taken on added significance since the advent of the housing meltdown and recent financial crisis. Now, my involvement in mortgage and foreclosure issues began fairly recently when I became president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago and sponsor of a Federal Reserve initiative called MORE, or the Mortgage Outreach and Research Effort. Prior to that, I had worked with our community affairs staff as they partnered with community organizations across our district to address foreclosure issues. In Chicago, one of the most successful partnerships has been with Neighborhood Housing Services of Chicago, NHS. Much of this work started in the late 1990s, culminating in a program called HOPI, the Home Ownership Preservation Initiative, in 2003. NHS, with our support, has pioneered many techniques to combat the ill effects of foreclosures. HOPI has been instrumental in saving hundreds of families from foreclosure, hosting loan modification and counseling events, completing HAMP modifications for borrowers, and creating strategies for reclaiming vacant properties. As part of the MORE initiative, the Chicago Fed, together with Federal Reserve banks around the country and the Board of Governors in Washington, is also addressing foreclosure mitigation and neighborhood stabilization efforts through outreach, research, and meetings with industry experts. Perhaps most important so far has been our work to bring resources to the hardest-hit cities and regions of the country. Home buyer counseling, for example, is a critical need in certain areas. Under the MORE program, we've helped many of our community development partners organize day-long mega events that have served thousands of troubled borrowers. Moreover, we've partnered with and brought together housing advocates, lenders, academics, and key government officials to discuss foreclosure issues and develop solutions. In some cases, alliances have been formed right on the spot to create and implement programs to keep people in their homes. The MORE program also has included a partnership with the U.S. Departments of Labor and the Treasury and the Hope Now Unemployment Task Force to assist unemployed homeowners at risk of losing their homes to foreclosure. This collaboration led to the creation of an online tool that allows homeowners and servicers to document unemployment insurance benefits as income to qualify for federally sponsored mortgage modification programs. In 2008, each reserve bank within the Federal Reserve System created an online foreclosure resource center. These websites provide local constituents and consumers with easy access to information on foreclosure-related resources. Features of our Foreclosure Resource Center include an enhanced foreclosure mitigation toolkit, which provides detailed steps and information for localities seeking to develop foreclosure prevention activities of their own, and a new foreclosure recovery resource guide, which seeks to assist consumers who have gone through this process. A number of Federal Reserve research projects have been initiated as part of the MORE program. They include several studies focusing on foreclosure prevention, financial education, and adverse neighborhood effects resulting from foreclosures. In this latter category, community affairs researchers across the Federal Reserve System launched a study in 2009 of the planning and early implementation stages of the Federal Neighborhood Stabilization Program. The research team conducted a series of interviews with more than 90 recipients of HUD's NSP funds in the fall of 2009, which, of course, we've talked greatly about today. They will release a report based on these interviews and other data in late 2010. This report will provide the first nationwide examination of the impact of the NSP. In order to leverage the work of MORE and to make information available to practitioners in the field, we've been active in sponsoring several conferences. In addition to the conference held here today, the Federal Reserve System and the FDIC are co-hosting a two-day conference this fall that will highlight policy-oriented research focused on the U.S. housing and mortgage markets. The first day of the conference will be dedicated to mortgage foreclosures, including research on the current situation and outlook, neighborhood spillover effects, and evaluations of efforts to mitigate foreclosures. The second day of the conference will present research on the future of housing finance. Somebody told me earlier that this conference was overbooked, and so you might want to think about signing up soon if you're interested in this. All of the initiatives I've described as part of our MORE program serve to help supplement work being done on foreclosure prevention and neighborhood stabilization, both locally and nationally. My hope is that all of you here today will draw upon this information and the success of the MORE program to explore new and creative ways to address these important challenges. At the Fed, we will continue to do our part to encourage further research, participate in the dialogue, and coordinate concerned groups that want to work towards sustainable housing markets. Thank you very much.